listening to highlights from the Creative Processes interview with functional neurosurgeon Ben Shafty. This podcast is supported by the Ann Michalski Foundation.
So I think in terms of creativity, we usually use the accepted definition, which is any thought process that is novel and useful, meaning it's an idea that is relatively rare in terms of frequency, but it's also useful in order for something to be creative. And that can be verbal creativity or visual creativity or artistic creativity. And there's, you know, it's a whole world. But I think the common thing that happens whenever somebody is doing a creative process is that we have an infrequent connection between two or more thought processes that weren't meant to be connected. That's when we get that, you know, sort of eureka moment, when we were able to sort of fuse two things that or more that weren't meant to be fused, and we generate something that is actually great. And to me, you know, this is one of the most interesting things that the human mind sort of evolved and specialized to do. So I feel when you think about the evolution of the human brain, just like other animals have sort of specialized in speed or keeping warm or, you know, gathering food, I feel like our brain specialized into being creative and flexible and being able to generate different solutions to a given problem. And to me, it's not written in my bio or anywhere else, but I used to cook a lot and I used to work in cooking. And to me, this is the most creative process, right? Taking something and generating a taste or a flavor or something completely different out of it. But in terms of, as you said, more elusive processes like creativity or high order cognitive functions, we don't really know or understand where they are inside the brain. There's no creativity cortex like we have motor cortex or sensory cortex or visual cortex. So when we started with this project or series of projects, we tried to think if this function, just like other higher cognitive functions, cannot be explained by a specific area inside the brain, then what happens? Where does the magic happen? And the answer, as you said, was that it's a network-dependent function. It doesn't originate from a specific area inside the brain, but it originates from multiple brain networks sort of all of a sudden synchronizing to generate that unexpected function. One of the things that makes us human is that we have a spontaneous stream of consciousness, right? There's a constant sort of thought process that's internal and unique to us as individuals that constantly accompany us throughout our lives, right? Today, we think that spontaneous stream of consciousness is generated by a brain network, which is called a default mode network. And people called it a default mode network because initially nobody understood what it does. People knew that it's active whenever we're not busy directing our attention to a specific task. So that's when people understood that this network is working. And with time and a lot of studies that are based on fMRI, people have started understanding this network is actually in charge of that spontaneous stream of thoughts, of remembering the past, of imagining the future, everything that we do that's introspective. And that network is basically what makes us human. And when it's working well, it's great. But we have some states in which that network is overactive or underactive, and we associate these states with various types of mental illnesses like depression, schizophrenia, and a bunch of other mental illnesses. And I think that spontaneous stream of thought is what stands in the basis of the creative thought process. And while generating a creative thought is a process that takes milliseconds, so if you channel it or drive it towards generating a constantly creative thought process, then I would assume that it's not doing what it usually does, which is generating that sense of self. And this is why a lot of people, when they write, for an instance, they get lost in writing. And then it happens to all of us that we do something that's really creative, paint, or we play an instrument, or we write. And it feels like time went by in a second because we directed the cognitive resource that we usually direct into maintaining that stream of consciousness and sense of self and time sensation into that creative process. If you talk about Stephen King or Jerry Seinfeld, these people are creative for a living. So they know how to channel this internal thought process and generate these unexpected connections in order to generate the same sort of type of creativity, whether it's, you know, a book or a joke or something else. And there are many other people that can harness creativity. For the most of us, it's a process that starts with that spontaneous stream of thought when all of a sudden the default mode network synchronizes with other brain networks that sort of channel that internal mental process into generating something that is useful or helpful or something like that. So there's a specific moment in which our internal stream of thought is synchronized with a goal-directed or intentional network. And that's when the creative process happens. And that's the sort of magic that we were trying to find or analyze with the study that you're talking about. I'm one of the people that believe that anything that we as human beings can imagine will eventually happen. So I feel like if somebody has raised the possibility of having brain implants that augment the brain and generate additional functions, I feel like it will eventually happen. And there's a lot of private companies like Elon Musk's Neuralink and others that are busy designing these interfaces and planning these devices. Of course, nothing is available or is even close to completion right now. The next step would be, of course, to modulate them. Just like any other thing in medicine, it will start or it has already started with pathological states, which we've talked about, and people that are looking for potential interventions through TMS, transcranial magnetic stimulation. It doesn't necessarily have to be invasive. But of course, the next step, especially when we're talking about brain, and I assume eventually it will reach a point where we'll be able to pick and choose what we want to augment about our own brains. I assume that the technology will be there eventually, and this is something that will be a part of the natural evolution of the human race. There are other mental health conditions like depression and schizophrenia, as you said, and I'm intentionally bringing up these two because the way I see them, they represent two different types of default mode dysfunction. Depression has many subtypes and it's apparently many different disorders. But one of the subtypes that we're studying in my lab is what we call rumination type depression. It's the depression type in which people keep ruminating and keep focusing on their internal thought process and they just cannot shake off and concentrate on anything that happens in the outside world. When somebody has rumination type depression, they just can't do that. And they keep on ruminating and they keep on thinking about things that have happened and they just can't shake them off. And that leads to significant depressive symptoms. And the other side of that default mode dysfunction is, for example, schizophrenia at the beginning of the disease, where they're very active and patients are really stormy and they have a lot of psychosis, which is the inability to differentiate external stimuli from internal stimuli. So they have a lot of auditory and visual hallucinations. And basically the default mode network is so hyperactivated that you can't tell the difference between what's happening inside your brain to what's happening outside. So these are two extreme conditions of what some people think is default mode network dysfunction or network dysfunction inside the brain that are also overlapping with the creative thought process, right? Because in order for something to work well in the brain or in the body, we need everything to be balanced, right? We need everything to be just right. And the entire biological system that is the brain or the body is generated to support that balance. Once an imbalance happens, and that can happen for a lot of different reasons that honestly we don't understand most of them, but that can generate states of extreme hyper default mode activation or creativity. But then it's not creativity because it's not really useful, right? If somebody is having hallucinations or tries to do creative processes from a manic starting point, then it's of course not creative, but it's a pathological state. In terms of the default mode, I think that what we try to do in my lab is, first of all, understand how the network works when everything is okay, right? When everything works well. And that's the basis to us being able to understand pathologies that are associated with the network. We have to really understand what happens in the normal condition, in the normal person, in the non-diseased state. We have a lot of correlative evidence from fMRI studies, but our approach, which uses electrodes that are implanted inside the brain, and we can talk about it more later, helps us understand how the normal brain signal transduction happens on a millisecond kind of level and in multiple areas inside of the brain. So the first thing that we're trying to do is characterize the default mode network in the normal brain. And from that, we're trying to take it to pathological state like the rumination type depression we've talked about. It's still very far from actually basing interventions based on that, but hopefully one day we will get there. So mind wandering is another basic function that we associate with the default mode network. And again, our ability to mind wander can be a positive thing, right? If we harness it into a mental break or rest or something like that, it's the extreme form of that is probably meditation. And it can be a bad thing if we basically are unable to concentrate with everything and our mind constantly wanders. And it becomes a really big issue today with all screens and social media, and our ability to generate positive mind wandering is getting lost because our attention span has become a TikTok length, sort of an attention span. And our ability to just allow our mind to wander in a healthy ways is getting lost. So a lot of people are interested in the changes that happen with that very basic and critical form of thinking or of spontaneous thought. It's hard to investigate, and we haven't had a very big success in investigating it because most of the patients that I work with have underwent surgery or an invasive intervention, and the setting is very hard. They're having a hard time basically mind wandering. So the way we study these functions and networks in my lab, and there's many other people that are doing the same, is that we basically ask our patients that are undergoing surgery, and it's usually a surgery that we call stereo EEG or intracranial monitoring. And these are patients usually with intractable epilepsy, meaning their epilepsy has not responded to any form of drug therapy or anti-epileptic drugs. So we offer them and we tell them, if you're interested, we have a bunch of research studies that you're welcome to be a part of. And most of them are interested in participating because it's a lot of fun. It helps them pass the time and it gives them some sort of a meaning, and they can potentially help other patients that suffer from other disorders. So a lot of them say, yes, I'm happy to participate. And that gives us a very unique opportunity in which we have an awake, behaving, fully conscious human being with electrodes inside of their brain. And that's what makes these studies relatively unique, because nobody will implant patients especially to study creativity, right? Nobody will agree to that. No sane human being would undergo a brain surgery just so he can help us understand more about the default mode network or any other type of network. Nobody will implant patients especially to study creativity, right? But these patients have already underwent their implant for clinical reasons, and they're happy to participate. And it gives us a unique opportunity in which we can record from multiple areas inside the brain while they're performing a task. In addition to that, we can deliver stimulation through the electrodes and manipulate a specific brain network or a specific brain area. And that way we can prove causality. And that's one of the things we did in the paper that you've read. We actually stimulated the default mode network, and we've shown that when we desynchronize the default mode network or interrupt its activity, people are not able to generate uses that are as creative as they were able to generate before or without stimulation. So that was a really strong proof of causality, that the default mode network is the driving force behind, or the driving network behind, our ability to generate creative thoughts. So again, that's another philosophical question, whether this is our next step in evolution, right? Where we don't have to concentrate and we don't have to focus our attention on anything, but we need to be able to follow 20 different stimuli all at once. Maybe that's the way the human race is walking to, and maybe that's the next sort of attribute that we need to be successful in the future world. I don't know. I do agree that a lot of evidence, a lot of scientific evidence are pointing out that these are not healthy processes, and that they significantly impair our mental health and our well-being. I feel like the best thing to do is to try and minimize the exposure to these social networks and online media in younger ages, and also to find something that gives us a break from these things that are constantly hovering around us, right? They're so available, the phone, the screens, all of these things. If we can give ourselves and our loved ones a chance to get a break from that during their day, I feel like this will help minimize the effect. So I think the main thing and the reason I went into neurosurgery, because it gives you the most intimate sort of understanding of what happens in the brain. And I think when you operate on a patient, when you implant electrodes, when you do a resection for epilepsy or any other type of brain surgery, it sort of puts you in a position where you basically understand the significance of the brain and the changes that the brain undergoes. And a great example, my old boss in Tel Aviv, Professor Zvi Ram, we used to see our patients, postoperative patients together, and they used to tell us, I can walk and I can talk, but I don't feel the same person. And that spot where a person is walking and talking and is seemingly okay on the outside, but they don't feel like they're the same person or they've underwent a major change, that's the spot that sort of drew my mind and made me really interested in in studying what makes us ourselves. And I thought that creativity is one of the main things that happen to us that sort of define our uniqueness as human beings, because it's a very personalized thought process, right? Everybody is creative in a very unique and special way. So to me, it was as somebody who's basically interested and likes other human beings. To me, the question, what makes us unique and what makes us human, sort of distills itself into figuring it out what happens when we are creative. What's interesting about meditation is that people that are professional meditators, their default mode network is not hyperactive, but it's underactive when they meditate. So basically, when they meditate, they sort of break free from their spontaneous stream of consciousness. That's how meditation should work. But it's interesting to see it happens in real life when you put Tibetan monks in the fMRI or see what happens with EEG, with surface EEG electrodes when they meditate, the default mode network is being suppressed. And that's amazing to see because it becomes a goal-directed activity. And that doesn't happen in people who meditate as a hobby. So I think another thing that makes us human is our generational transfer of information, our ability to distill the knowledge that was passed on to us and then pass it on and give it our unique stamp is again another one of these things that makes us human. And I think the main thing that I've learned from my mentors and the main thing that I would like to pass on to my children is the notion that compassion is the most important thing that we have as human beings. And hopefully I'll be able to teach myself and then them how to be also self-compassionate. I feel this is a very good coping mechanism to this extremely violent and stimulating world that's happening out there. I feel like whatever profession you choose, whatever you choose to study, just remember that there's a human being on the other side. And this is something that social networks and online media are trying to make us forget, that there's actually a person on the other side of that video or text. So I feel like this is the main thing that I would like to pass on to my children to help them remember that eventually we are all human.
We hope you've enjoyed listening to these highlights. To listen to the latest episodes or learn more about participating in exhibitions or interviews, click on subscribe. Thank you for listening.